Well, we continue our series on church history. We're at the end of the 200s AD, going into the early 300s AD. And we are in this section that the historian Nick Needham, in his 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, in his volumes on church history, he regarded this section of from persecution to toleration. From persecution to toleration. And we already looked at some of this, so tonight is part two. The last time we met, we noted that the beginning of the 200s was fairly peaceful, and many wealthy Christians existed. Wealthy people came to Christ. Church buildings were built and set aside. And the first Christian cemetery was built in the city of Rome. Pretty special in the early 200s. Well, persecution broke out under Decius. So number one in our outline in this section was persecutions under emperors Decius and Valerian. Decius is the one who tortured Origen of Alexandria, who died from his injuries a few years later in 254 AD. But Decius and Valerian persecuted the church. It was interesting, as I noted, Decius had been a military man, military general. And when he observed the 1,000-year anniversary of the founding of Rome in 247 AD, remember the legend has it that the city of Rome was founded in 753 BC. Counting down to Christ, then you count up. 753 plus 247 is 1,000. At that 1,000-year anniversary in 247 AD, Christians did not partake because it involved pagan festivities. And he believed that Christians were not loyal and threatened the unity of the Roman Empire. And then in 248, a series of invasions took place under the Germanic tribes, such as the Goths. And they invaded in several places, even going through Spain, across the Mediterranean, down to Carthage, as well as in the east in the Balkans. So he believed that the pagan gods were mad because Christians were drawing people away from them. And the Goths then were part of that judgment by the pagan gods. Well, he took power militarily. He only was an emperor a couple years because he died fighting the Goths. Valerian, emperor from 253 to 260, took up the torch of tormenting and persecuting Christians. And we had noted Cyprian of Carthage was the most famous victim of Valerian. Well, his son, after Valerian, his son Gallienus, he was one who was a Neoplatonist. He was one who said persecution will not get rid of Christians, will never be successful. And he's the one, Gallienus, as emperor, that said education is what is key. And I noted that we've seen that in our own day. The neo-pagans took over our education in the United States of America. In the Bible, we're told not to be surprised by persecution. But it is false teachers, really, that is the great danger. Bad education. Gallienus was one who observed that. Now, he was a Neoplatonist, and Plato believed that the main problem of the human race was ignorance. So that played a role as well with his thinking. The second part of the outline we looked at was the empire at the end of the 3rd century AD. In that period of time, we noted that the first country in church history was the country of Armenia as the first country that established Christianity as its national religion. And you remember they were just east of Asia Minor. The province of Cappadocia was on the east side of the Roman Empire in Asia Minor, and the country of Armenia is still there today. It was the first country through Gregory the Illuminator, and he was the illuminator because he brought light into darkness. With the gospel, he brought the king of Armenia along with his whole family to faith in Christ by the grace of God. And he ended up being the Archbishop of Armenia. So it wasn't Rome. So we're going to be looking into Constantine and what happens when Christianity begins to get the level of official recognition as a religion and tolerated to eventually being the established religion of the Roman Empire. But the first country was Armenia that established Christianity as its official national religion in 300 AD. Well, we noted too, there were three new religious movements in that period of time at the end of the 200s AD. Sun worship, you had sun, moon, and stars. Sun worship became popular at that time. Nick Needham pointed out that's where transitioning, interestingly, from worshiping one idol, the sun, to worshiping the true Son of God, Jesus Christ, that it actually made the transition more smooth for some of the pagans in God's smiling providence. Neoplatonism was another big spiritual movement at that time under the fall of Plotinus. We looked at that. Remember, Nick Needham said Plotinus was one of the most influential philosophers human history has ever known. And he is the one who essentially turned Plato's philosophy into a spiritual belief system. And we looked at Manichaeism as well, developed by Mani, and that was just a new form of Gnosticism at that period of time. So now it's up to point three in the outline, the final struggle from Diocletian to Constantine. The Emperor Diocletian was a soldier who seized power in 284 AD. Which is, we've seen multiple times already, they had a lot of military generals and soldiers that would seize power at various times. But what was unique about Diocletian is that he was a great political reformer. Drastically reorganized the Roman Empire. With my background in public policy, I was real fascinated reading some of this history of what he did. I noted some of it here as he divided the administration of the empire into east and west, each having two rulers. So since you had four rulers then, so he's looking at it all and saying, this is a vast, huge empire. How about if we have two in the west and two in the east? And again, we've said, based on language, it's kind of been that way since the first century, where the West was more Latin and the East was more Greek. Well, the senior emperor, the senior ruler of the West and the senior ruler of the East were called Augustus, and the junior ruler of the West and the junior ruler of the East was called Caesar. And what's real interesting as well is you think in your mind, well, the senior one rules over all and then he's just getting help from the junior one. Well, it's not the case. The way Diocletian set it up is that Augustus, the senior emperor, ruled specific provinces in the West, and the Augustus in the East, the senior emperor, ruled specific provinces. And then their junior emperor, Caesar, ruled the other provinces of the West, and the Caesar in the East ruled the other provinces that the Augustus, the senior one, did not. There's a weakness in that. We're going to see that here play out, where they kind of have some rivalry, almost functioning as two different countries at that point. Diocletian also divided up West and East into 12 new administrative districts, and they were called dioceses. Essentially dioceses. And that's where we think of kind of ends up into the church having certain dioceses within the Episcopal Church, for instance. Certain districts. All that's just a word for districts, in other words. So he's thinking, okay, divided up east and west, two rulers over east, but then they rule different provinces in the east and different provinces in the west, as well divided up in each into 12 new administrative districts. And he also reformed the court system, a civil service, working in the government as a government employee. He reformed the army and many economic reforms as well he instituted. So this man was a mega reformer. For the Roman Empire, it probably compares to Solon among the Greeks. When you think back in Greek history, as somebody who reformed both the political system and the legal system. All of his reforms allowed the empire in the East to survive another 1,000 years. But in my mind, actually facilitated what we're going to see play out here for some warring for power among these rulers. Diocletian, for most of his reign, had a policy of religious toleration. What we see play out with him is bad company corrupts good morals. So Diocletian, he's the Augustus in the East, and his Caesar, his junior emperor, is Galerius. Galerius died 311 AD. Galerius was extremely hostile to Christianity. So Diocletian starts out tolerating Christians in his provinces in the East. He's the Augustus, the supreme emperor in the East. His junior emperor, Galerius, is one who hates Christianity, extremely hostile to Christianity, and he's ruling the other provinces in the East. In 297 AD, Diocletian ordered all Manichaeans to be put to death. So, Manichaeism was that new form of Gnosticism that arose under Mani in that period of time, but it wasn't the traditional gods and goddesses of the Roman Empire. In 303 AD, Galerius persuaded Diocletian to persecute Christians, inflicting the last and most terrible persecution of the church. So when we think back in church history under the Roman Empire, when was the last and most terrible persecution of the church? In that section of history, it was under Diocletian in 303 AD. He removed all Christians from the government and then gave three edicts in 303 AD. And a fourth edict in 304 AD. So, he also removed all Christians from the army. He wants none in the government, he wants none in his army. And then he issues these three edicts in 303 AD and another in 304 AD. The first edict, first order that came out, the decree of Augustus, the senior emperor in the East, is destroy all church buildings, burn all Bibles, and forbid all Christian worship. Destroy all church buildings, burn all Bibles, and forbid Christian worship. Now again, in that period of time, there weren't as many Bibles as there are today, remember. We didn't yet have the Gutenberg printing press. Bible was an extremely precious thing, copied by hand. His second edict, all clergy, all leaders in the church were to be arrested and imprisoned. His third edict, this is the third one in the same year, 303 AD, was that all clergy, all leaders were to offer sacrifice to the pagan gods or be tortured. Now this is a man that started out tolerating Christianity, but was heavily influenced by his junior emperor, Caesar, Galerius. His fourth edict of Diocletian in 304 AD was that all citizens of the empire were to sacrifice to the pagan gods or be executed. In the East, the persecution was fierce all over, as you can imagine, with these four edicts, with Diocletian as Augustus, the senior emperor. In the West, the persecution was fierce where Augustus Maximilian ruled. So Maximilian was the senior emperor in the West at this time. And he ruled the provinces around Italy and Northwest Africa. And he persecuted Christianity fiercely in Italy and Northwest Africa. But his Caesar, his junior emperor, was Constantius. Constantius was tolerant in Spain, France, and Britain, where he ruled. Remember, the Roman Empire went up the western part of Europe through Spain and France and into Britain, through Gaul, called at that time, France. And Constantius destroyed only a few buildings, but executed no one in Spain, France, and Britain. Just a few buildings were destroyed, but he executed no one. So here you get all this variance, in some sense, and influence, but they're over different areas, right? In 305 AD, Diocletian stepped down from power, being ill. He had originally said he only wanted to rule for 20 years. So he was roughly at that period of time. But he was severely ill. And because his original intent was to step down basically after 20 years, he forced his fellow Augustus Maximilian to do so also. So remember, Maximinian was the Augustus in the West. Diocletian's the Augustus in the East. He's the one that set this up, right? Diocletian. So when he's stepping down in 305, he's forcing the other Augustus to do the same, enforcing their own term limit, basically. But he was ill, so you're like, well, was it really wanting to step down, or is it just too ill to continue? Well, what that meant was Galerius, who was the Caesar in the East, extremely anti-Christian, he became the new Augustus in the East, the senior emperor in the East, which intensified the persecution of Christians in the East, if you could intensify it any. But in the West, the tolerant Constantius became Augustus in the West then, because Diocletian forced the Augustus Maximinian to step down. So the tolerant, by God's grace, then the tolerant Constantius became Augustus in the West. Well, when Constantius died in 306, just a year later, in God's providence, his military troops made his son Constantine, who was born about 280 AD and died in 337 AD, but his military troops, Constantius's, after Constantius's death in 306, made his son Constantine the new Caesar in the northern British city of York, is where he lived. Remember, we've got New York, right, in our colonies, right? That's why it's called New York, city of New York, right? State of New York. Well, what do we have here? One in the East, Galerius, that extremely anti-Christian. He's the new Augustus. In the West, after the death of Constantius, we have Constantine. Constantine controlled Britain, France, and Spain as the senior emperor. And a person named Maxentius Maxentius was the Caesar then who controlled Italy and Northwest Africa, those provinces. Constantine at this time was tolerant of Christianity, just like his father. That's the way he started out. He was not a Christian, but he tolerated Christianity. His Caesar, his junior emperor, Maxentius, was anti-Christian. In 311 AD, 5 years later, Constantine's been in power for 5 years, from 306 to 311. In 311 AD, Galerius finally gave up persecuting the church in the east, the one who convinced Diocletian to persecute Christians. He finally gave up in 311 AD. He admitted he failed to destroy Christianity, issuing an edict of toleration. Nick Needham points out the Christians really did well standing for their faith in the East during that period of time, compared to earlier in the mid-200s with Decius and Valerian. Not as well, perhaps, there, where a lot paid, remember, for fake certificates or just gave in and worshiped to the gods. And then you had the lapsus controversy once the persecution ended. They went back in. And then you ended up with the controversy with Cyprian of Carthage, with Stephen, the Bishop of Rome. How do we treat these, all these Christians that lapsed? Well, they didn't fare as well there. But this time they did fare well in the East. They stood up for Christianity quite strongly, Needham points out. And Galerius admits in 311 he failed to destroy Christianity in the East. Interestingly, Galerius at that time in 311 was a sick man, and he even asked Christians to pray for him. He had the gall to do that even. Isn't that amazing? Think of their testimony to him. That's where Pastor Ron's quote is, you know, you can live well without Christ, but you cannot die well without Christ. After Galerius died, the East was divided between Licinius, who controlled Greece and the Balkans, and Maximinus, have all these different Maxes, Maximinus Daia, D-A-I-A, Maximinus Daia controlled Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. Right? So they each controlled different provinces. Licinius was tolerant of Christians. Maximinus Daia persecuted the church. So again, you get different treatment by different rulers over different provinces again. In 312 AD, the uneasy peace in the West ended. Again, you had Constantine being tolerant, and you had his Caesar Maxentius anti-Christian. How do they get along? Well, the uneasy peace between them ended. Constantine, with a smaller army, even though he's the senior emperor, he invaded Italy. Remember, he'd been up in York, Britain. With a smaller army, he invades Italy, taking on the other ruler in the west. The two armies faced each other across the Milvian, M-I-L-V-I-A-N, Milvian Bridge, on the River Tiber outside the city of Rome. Up to this point, Constantine had been a sun worshiper. A sun worshiper. A sun, moon, and stars. That's what he had been up to this point. Tolerant of Christianity, just like his father, Constantius, but he was a sun worshiper, a pagan. Had one idol, he worshiped the sun. But the night before the battle of the Milvian Bridge, Constantine had a dream in which he saw the first two letters in Greek of the name of Christ. And those first two letters are chi and rho. Chi and rho, the chi rho sign, it's kind of called. The X and the P is the way we would look at it Okay, like a capital X and a capital P. And in that dream, seeing these first two Greek letters of the name of Christ, they appeared atop each other like a cross. Like a cross. So I put it on the board here. This is what he saw. And it looks like a cross. What he saw in his dream. First two letters of the name of Christ, Chi and Rho, and in our vernacular, like an X and a P, but then the X is turned. So normally like this, but it's turned, right? And then the P at the top, but it looks like a cross. Now sometimes it's shown like this, is what Nick Needham points out, the Chi-Rho sign, where sometimes rather than like this, the X is turned like a normal X with the P in the middle. Constantine also saw or heard, it's debated a bit, but he saw or heard in his dream, quote, by this sign you will conquer. By this sign you will conquer. Now I'll just say, as a side note, you know, this is where we had talked about the Montanists, the early Pentecostals, is we don't believe that it's typical to have all of these miraculous signs and all signs and wonders as gifts given to certain people and all of that, but God can still do all of these things if he wants to at any time. And here we have some unique smiling providence of God affecting Constantine, who was a sun worshiper right before this key battle. The next day then, he had the sign painted on the shields of his troops. The Chi-Rho sign. So we're the first two letters of the name of Christ. And he had heard or saw in the dream, by this sign you will conquer. The next day he has that Chi-Rho sign put on the shields of all his troops. And then he prayed to the God of the Christians for victory. Constantine won a crushing triumph over Maxentius, who was killed in battle. So his Caesar, he took on in battle here at the Battle of Milvian Bridge, and with the Chi-Rho sign on the shields of all his troops, after praying to the Christian God for victory, he won a decisive victory, and that Caesar, the other ruler, Maxentius, was killed in battle. He was only 32 years old at this time. Remember, his father died 1 year after becoming Augustus. And then the troops made Constantius, his son Constantine, the emperor, as a young man. So here at the age of 32, Constantine was the sole master of the West. He believed the Christian God gave him the victory and from then on acted as the great champion and protector of Christianity. To wield the physical sword to protect Christians. Apart from the Apostle Paul, Constantine's acceptance of the Christian faith, Nick Needham says, was the most important conversion in history. Unquote. Aside from Saul's conversion in Acts 9 that's recorded for us, he says in church history, the most important conversion then is Constantine's. This is one of the reasons why we must pray for our rulers. Who we have as rulers is important. Nick Needham says Constantine deserved the title given him, quote, Constantine the Great. Constantine the Great. Now you've got to think in your mind. Remember, from the early 100s AD, under Emperor Trajan, is when the persecutions officially were going. I mean, you had isolated ones, right, with Nero in the 60s AD, etc. But when it was really broad, it was Emperor Trajan in the early 100s, till this point right here, roughly 200 years off and on, and there were periods in the early 200s with peace. There was some peace at the end of the 200s after Decius and Valerian as emperors persecuted the church because they were dealing with outside enemies. Remember, the Germanic tribes were invading, and then there was another empire on the east that invaded also a couple of times in the later 200s. So the military is saying, we can't worry about Christians at this point. We're focused on outside enemies, and the empire for a period of time looked like it was going to fall from outside enemies. Okay, so the church got a little reprieve at that time as well. We covered the last time we met. So that was very important as well. But for the most part, there was a lot of persecution broadly in the Roman Empire for 200 years. From Emperor Trajan till this very point. You say, well, Constantine the Great, what was he like? What was his personality? Everyone has strengths and weaknesses. Nick Needham points out that Constantine was prone to flattery, a flashy appearance, and especially the older he got, not trusting of those around him. But you can imagine there was a lot of military coups that took place in the history of Rome. He knew about all the history. He was one, though, that was very generous with money. He had a sense of justice and fairness when he ruled. And he was sexually pure, which was very rare at that time for a ruler of the Roman Empire. Now, some historians debate Constantine's conversion to Christianity. Was it real or not? Well, there's one story, I didn't write it on the board, but Constantine's wife, Fausta, had falsely accused Crispus, her stepson, of trying to rape her. And it was a false accusation. But in 326 AD, Constantine put him to death. Regrettably, Constantine, in anger, did not give Crispus an opportunity to defend himself. He trusted his wife and the accusation that was made. He himself was sexually pure, and it must have really offended him, such an accusation. Some would say in old age, Constantine had leanings toward the Arians who denied Christ was God in the flesh. So those are a couple of the negatives that some historians put forth for Constantine. Well, how about some positives to argue in favor that it was a genuine conversion, even though obviously he's not perfect. If we're saved, it's through faith alone and Christ alone. Constantine, think about his conversion. Constantine had nothing to gain politically or militarily by professing the Christian faith. He gets a dream to him personally that in that sign he would conquer, but that's just a dream to him. Militarily, Christianity was not popular. Politically, Christianity was not popular. And yet he did profess the Christian faith. When you profess the Christian faith, when you're not gaining anything from other human beings by it, that's a good sign that it's true conversion. Constantine regularly attended Christian worship, which is a good sign. He listened. I really was fascinated with this. Nick Needham points out that Constantine listened to the longest sermons without complaining. How many genuine, real Christians can listen to long sermons without complaining? As an evidence of genuine faith. Okay, so Constantine regularly attended church worship, even sat through long sermons, never complained. And he observed Easter every year with great seriousness. He gave many speeches that condemned pagan idolatry and praised Christianity, also a great sign of conversion. Publicly confessing Christ before men, condemning pagan idolatry before men in speeches. And then when his courtiers cheered, saying, oh, great job, when he was condemning the pagans and praising Christianity, he would point to heaven. Say, may God be praised, not me. Okay, back to our historical story. Well, Constantine was triumphing over Maxentius in the west. The Battle of Milvian Bridge. War broke out in the east between Licinius and Maximinus. Licinius won, controlling the entire Eastern Empire himself. This is one of the weaknesses of the political reforms of Diocletian. Where one rules over certain provinces, the other over another. Well, what if one gets very unhappy with the other one, and then they say, okay, I'll take my troops and take you on, when you're not pleased with what's going on. So Licinius wins control of the Eastern Empire himself. So now you have Constantine in the west, controlling all of the west, and Licinius controlling all of the east in the empire, and they met in Milan in northern Italy. And in Milan, in northern Italy, they agreed on a policy of freedom for all religions, pagan and Christian. Freedom for all religions, pagan and Christian. That particular position has basically been America's position under the First Amendment at the federal level. At America's founding, 1787, Constitution was written, U.S. Constitution, ratified 1789. State governments, many of them had established religions. Many would tolerate other ones within their boundaries and jurisdictions. But true freedom for all religions, free exercise of religion, in other words, that's the, under the Federal Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the first right that's there, is guaranteeing freedom for all religions federally in the United States of America. But that's what Constantine and Licinius agreed to, and they met in Milan in northern Italy. For the first time, then, the empire, the Roman Empire, gave Christianity full legal status and official toleration. That's a big deal when you think about it. They were recognized as an official religion and with the right to freely exercise that religion. Licinius, though, was still a pagan. So you have this agreement between Constantine, Emperor of the West, who's a Christian, and Licinius in the East, controls all of the Eastern Empire, but he's pagan. But they met in Milan in this agreement for freedom of religion for all religions, pagan and Christian. Constantine's Christian, Licinius pagan. But Licinius grew increasingly anti-Christian over time, and he removed all Christians from his army and prohibited all bishop meetings. In 320 AD, he started persecuting Christians violently in the east. In 324 AD, open war broke out between Constantine and Licinius, between the west of the Roman Empire under Constantine and the east under Licinius. Licinius violated the agreement they had for freedom of religion. They agreed at Milan. So you could say legally, in a sense, Constantine had a right to say, you broke the treaty. When Licinius vehemently started persecuting Christians in 320 AD, banning all bishop meetings and removing all Christians from his army. In 324, open war broke out. Constantine invaded the east, regarding himself as fighting a holy war against Licinius, rescuing the Eastern Church from persecution. He regarded himself as fighting a holy war to protect Christians from persecution. That God has called him to protect Christians and Christianity. Constantine defeated Licinius at the Battle of Chrysopolis. Chrysopolis is Chrysopolis. It's in Bithynia in Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. Constantine the Great, Constantine the Christian, became the single, undisputed master of the entire Roman Empire at that point when he defeated Licinius to protect Christians from persecution. It is the stance of the Westminster Confession of Faith that that is the duty of all civil government rulers. They are accountable to the Lord Jesus Christ, who reigns and rules over all. And their duty is to protect the true religion. Now, we would say not to enter, as the Westminster Confession of Faith does, not to enter church affairs, not to enter disputes over theology, not to be in administration in the church, which we shall see. We'll get into the investiture struggle later on, but who's appointing and removing bishops? Civil government leaders should not be involved in those things. We have sphere sovereignty, church and state both under God. But the role of the state as God's minister is to administer God's laws, but to protect the true religion, Christianity. This is what Constantine did. I think what he did here was biblical. Especially when Licinius broke the treaty, the agreement they had in Milan. Now think of that treaty a minute. That's where you have Constantine, a Christian, agreeing for freedom of all religions. That gets to Roger Williams, right? In our colonial period in America, Roger Williams, the great Baptist that was there, came over in the 1630s to Massachusetts. But he supported freedom of religion. Forced conversion stinks in God's nostrils. To force people by threat of, I'm going to kill you unless you convert to Christianity. No, that stinks in God's nostrils. To force people to worship God. So, freedom of religion. Even of pagan religion. So, that ends the third section in this outline, from persecution to toleration. And again, really, with Christianity being recognized officially, legally, under Constantine, under that Milan agreement, and then with Constantine becoming the single undisputed master of the entire Roman Empire as a Christian. This last little section here, we'll end with this tonight, is number 4, Christian leaders from Decius to Constantine. So basically, from 249 AD to Constantine. From the death of Origen, remember it was Decius who tormented Origen of Alexandria, who was a bishop up in Palestine at that point in Caesarea, but he died a few years later in 254 AD, Origen did, from the persecution of Decius. But from the death of Origen in 254 AD to Constantine, many church leaders were active during this period of time. There's 6 just briefly mentioned here. Dionysius of Alexandria, he had died 265 AD. He was a Christian theologian. He opposed Sabellianism and defended the Trinity. He opposed that modalism, that idea that God is just one, but he appears as a Father at times, or appears as a Son, or appears as a Holy Spirit, but really he's not truly three persons. That's Sabellianism. He opposed that and defended the Trinity, Dionysius of Alexandria, who died 265 AD. Firmilian of Caesarea died 268 AD. Firmilian of Caesarea wrote letters with great criticisms of Stephen, who was Bishop of Rome. Now, these letters are very critical when you're examining church history. In a sense, they're very condemning of the Roman Catholic view of the Bishop of Rome. Because here you have where these letters, just like Cyprian as well, with the lapsus controversy, criticized Stephen and said, hey, you're not right on this. Same here. Many criticisms waged to say, they may have regarded the Bishop of Rome as the first among equals, but It was a church of bishops, not of one leading bishop of the Bishop of Rome, but of many bishops. But that's historical evidence one would go to, is these letters from Firmilian of Caesarea to criticize the Roman Catholics we have today who put all of their thing into the Pope, right? Another one, Gregory Theomaturgos. That's a long word, right? It literally means wonder worker. Wonder worker, Theomaturgos. Theomaturgos. He lived 213 AD to 270 AD. Amazingly, in his area where he was a bishop, almost all of the Neo-Caesarea people in Pontus, Asia Minor, were converted to Christianity. Practically all of them. Basically the whole area. It'd be like if you were over Welmer and practically everybody in Welmer becomes Christian because of your evangelism and ministerial efforts. But he died in 270 AD. Gregory Theomaturgos. Methodius is another one. Methodius died 311 AD. He had studied under Origen briefly, but opposed his heretical beliefs. But he was another one that was influential during that period of time. And remember, Origen had many heretical beliefs. Arnobius of Sicca is another one who was active, especially 304 to 310 AD. He wrote a book against the Gentiles, which is a very important book, Magneto points out, because it's a great historical record as to pagan beliefs and practices at that time. So what were they? He really laid them out when he's attacking the Gentiles, the pagan worshipers. That's Arnobius of Sicca. And lastly, Lactantius, 240 to 320 AD. And he wrote the Divine Institutes. The Divine Institutes, which was the first systematic theology in Latin. The first systematic theology in Latin. And you remember it was Origen who wrote First Principles, which was the first historical record we have of any theologian writing a systematic theology. Origen died 254 AD, where you're systematizing biblical doctrine under various subjects. Lactantius here, 240 to 320 AD, wrote Divine Institutes. You know, later on we'll get Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, right? His systematic theology in the 1500s. But here you have the first systematic theology in Latin. Okay, so that's God's interesting providence of building His church. Lord willing, we'll continue with some unique things that takes place with Constantine as the story continues next time we meet.